Dakota has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of a deal. But are you getting the deal and cash back? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love, savings, and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Levi's, Plow & Hearth, Adidas, Sephora, and Neiman Marcus. Stack sales on top of cash back and feel what it's like to know you're maximizing the savings. And it's easy to use. And you get your cash back sent to you through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers. And Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app or go to Rakuten.com to start saving today. It's the most rewarding way to shop. That's Rakuten. Rakuten.com.
Let's talk.
John Brown.
Margaret Thatcher is the latest in the Prime Minister's series, a woman of tremendous paradoxes, a conviction politician who is also a pragmatist, someone who delighted in a tough reputation, yet could be emotional, even tearful. She is the subject of a fascinating new book by Ian Dale. I'm delighted to welcome Ian back to the programme again. Ian, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Good to have you with us. It seems, for those of us of a certain generation, it seems quite sort of interesting that we're, you know, there are generations of young people, young adults growing up now who don't know an awful lot about, you know, the Iron Lady and 80s Britain and 70s Britain. So is this the reason that there's the spark behind this book?
Well, it's the centenary of her death, sorry, of her birth in October this year. It's 50 years since she was elected leader of the Conservative Party. So there's all sorts of things have come together to make this sort of relevant. But the reason I've written this book is because, and this is going to sound very pretentious, but about 2 years ago, I had to have some physio on my legs. So I signed up at the local gym, got myself a personal trainer. His name's Aaron. He was 25 then. And when he found out what I did for a living, he said, "Now, I've heard of Margaret Thatcher, but who was she? What did she do?" And I was thinking, oh my God. I mean, you just assume that those of us who grew up during her era, you just assume that everyone knows who she is, but younger generations don't. You actually have to be over, I think, 57 years old to have voted for Margaret Thatcher, which is an incredible statistic. So there's generations that have grown up in her shadow, if you like, where a lot of her policies have influenced the nation, even 35 years on since she resigned, we're still influenced by her. And yet, there's all of these younger generations don't really know an awful lot about her. So the book is aimed at them, really.
And of course, I mean, they won't know the huge changes or the way that Britain was in the mid-70s when she took over, you know, from... Yeah. And of course, she wasn't even supposed to take over. Was it Keith Joseph who was supposed to take over as the Conservative Party challenger against Ted Heath? And she was the campaign manager.
Well, not quite. Okay. After the second 1974 election, Keith Joseph made a fairly incendiary speech, which talked about the sort of lower classes, they shouldn't be breeding too much. And as you can imagine, even in those days, that was considered a bit beyond the pale. And there was no one else really on the right of the party that could take over the mantle. So she decided, okay, well, I'm going to run. I won't win, but I'm going to run. Well, she was the only one that dared challenge Ted Heath, and to the victor the spoils. And there were five other MPs came in the second round of voting, but she trounced them. And in a sense, you can compare her with the situation that Kemi Badenoch is in today, where she didn't have the full support of her party at the beginning. Most of her shadow cabinet were against her. She didn't really have any policies at the beginning. And yet 4 years later, she went on to win an election victory. And that must give Kemi Badenoch a little bit of hope.
Indeed. But again, for those of us who are around in the 80s, people talk about Marmite figures, you know, you like them or loathe them. But, you know, Thatcher, she was devised, she's become two-dimensional, hasn't she? Because she was hated by the left. I mean, there was all you had to do for all a comedian had to do was walk on stage, alternative comedian, go Thatcher, and people start going over the whole bits and pieces. CND, you know, but she was loved by the markets, but she was so much. She's so much more than a two-dimensional figure. So where do you start with this, Ian?
Well, there are lots of myths about Margaret Thatcher, and the last chapter of the book is just called 12 Myths, and I look at a lot of the things that people are taught, mainly by the left nowadays, that she either did or didn't do, and I sort of try and explode these myths. I mean, one of them was that she was just a conviction politician who would brook no argument from anybody and was quasi-dictatorial. The opposite was the truth. And after I'd finished the book, obviously you read through it again a couple of times to make sure you haven't made any mistakes. And one of the themes is that she was actually a pragmatist. She didn't go in all guns blazing like a bull in a china shop, like trade union reform, for example. She did that gradually over her 11 years. It wasn't all done at the beginning. And if you remember what the country was like in 1979, where effectively the trade unions ran the country, she didn't appoint an aggressive figure to do that. She appointed Jim Pryor, an emollient, red-cheeked Suffolk farmer, to do it. And he was there for the first 2 years. Then Norman Tebbit took over, a much more aggressive figure. But even he was sort of quite reticent to do everything all at once. And that worked. People say, well, she didn't like arguments. She loved having an argument. And a lot of the junior ministers that would have arguments with her, like John Major was one, where he came out of a meeting with her in 1986, and I think they were talking about welfare reform, and he'd had a furious row with her, and he said to Dennis Thatcher afterwards, oh, well, I've blown my chances now, haven't I? And he said, absolutely not. She'll have really enjoyed that. Next cabinet reshuffle, he was promoted to the cabinet. So there are a lot of things that she thought, that she did, that have proved to be just legend, and that they fit into a left-wing narrative that she was a right-wing bigot and all she wanted to do was destroy the country. The opposite is the truth.
Yeah, and it's the politics of politics, of conviction of your political beliefs. It's not the politics of the personality where, you know, backstabbing, light of the long lives, you said the awful thing about me. It's intellectual argument, isn't it?
And remember, when she was the first woman leader of a political party in this country, and we shouldn't forget that, Harriet Harman used to try and sort of brush over that and pretend that Margaret Thatcher hadn't broken through this glass ceiling. She's actually done an endorsement for me on the back of the book because she now recognises the importance of Thatcher as a female politician. But when she was first elected, about 2 years afterwards, a Soviet newspaper called her the Iron Lady. Mm. Now, they couldn't have done her a bigger favour because at that point, no one really knew what she believed. So she was able to use that over her entire career, actually. And I mean, first of all, she made fun of it, and she made a speech, I think, in Kensington Town Hall, where she said, "Here I stand in my Red Star chiffon dress, the Iron Lady of the Western world." And of course, the audience roared with laughter. But it was the best thing that they could have done with her. And of course, she played a huge role in the end of the Cold War.
This is the thing, because you cannot talk about Margaret Thatcher without, and people talk about the special relationship, but ye gods, she had her soulmate across the pond with Reagan, didn't she? And if you ever get the chance to hear Ronald Reagan apologising for invading Grenada without telling her, it is a beauty of a telephone call. But they were, weren't they? They recognised the value of an Atlantic land, but also Atlantic trade, about the markets. I mean, they let the markets run free, and they were both literally singing off the same spreadsheet.
Yes, but you mentioned the invasion of Grenada there. There were several times in the 8 years that he was president and she was prime minister where they did fall out. I mean, it wasn't that kind of relationship that Tony Blair had with George Bush, where I think George Bush would say jump and Tony Blair would say how high. That wasn't the relationship that Thatcher and Reagan had. And there was a moment, I think it was during the Falklands War, where she was berating him over something, and he was in the middle of a cabinet meeting, and he took the call, and she was sort of literally screaming down the phone, and he just held the phone up so the whole cabinet could listen and just said, "Isn't she magnificent?" So they could have these rows, but then get back on an even keel. Grenada, I think, was probably the most serious breach of the relationship, and they literally didn't talk for about 8 months because America had invaded a country where the Queen was the head of state and had given no notice to either the Queen or to Margaret Thatcher, and she took great exception to that.
Talking about wars, obviously the Falklands, the common narrative is that war, if you like, perhaps saved Thatcher. I mean, am I looking at a left-wing narrative on that one as well?
I'm afraid you are. You've fallen into that trap. Because the Poles were already recovering before the Falklands War. The economy was getting back on an even keel. So it's a complete myth to say that she won the 83 election just because of the Falklands War. Now, of course, it helped. I mean, she'd proved that she was the Iron Lady. Always remember Enoch Powell in the first debate on the day after the Argentinians had invaded, he said on the floor of the House of Commons, and she'd had a very tough time, he said to her, "Well, in the next few weeks, we are about to see what kind of ferrous metal the Iron Lady is made of." And on the day that the Argentinians surrendered, on the 14th of June 1982, he stood up in the House of Commons and I can't remember the exact quote, but said something along the lines of, "Well, she's proved that she is made of very tough metal indeed." And I found that one of the most tricky chapters to write because this is a short book. Mm. I mean, bear in mind that apparently we all have the attention span of a flea nowadays. I thought, well, there's no point in writing a book for a 25-year-old to read that is 400, 800 pages. So it's only 180-odd pages.
Wow.
But the point is that I had to decide what to put in, what to leave out. But how do you write about the Falklands War in 2,000 words, which is what I really had to do? It's very, very difficult. But I've tried to make it a pacey book, one that I tend to write as I speak. So it's not an academic book at all. And it's not meant to compete with Charles Moore's three-volume, 3,000-page biography. I mean, no one will ever surpass that, and I certainly haven't tried to. In fact, I say at the beginning of the book, if you've read Charles Moore's three volumes, please stop here. This book is not...
Presumably, the other thing is it's trying to explain to a younger generation that the miners' strike isn't Billy Elliot, and it's a bit more... Or do you just say, miners' strike, see Billy Elliot, and take away from that?
Well, that was the key industrial dispute in the whole time, and it was inevitable. Obviously, the Heath government had fallen over the strikes during that period, and she and her cabinet knew that at some point there would be a conflict with the miners. So Nigel Lawson, when he was Energy Secretary, he built up the coal stocks. So, I mean, it seems odd now where we don't have any coal and our energy whole industry is not reliant on coal, but at that point, if you didn't have the coal stocks, the country ground to a halt.
And moving from that, I mean, so many people are sort of hijacking about that thing we did not talk about called Brexit. So many people think, Margaret Thatcher would never have done this, but Margaret Thatcher was a European. I mean, Margaret Thatcher was, you know, she would be shaking her head about this whole situation at the moment, would you not say?
Well... we can never know how she would have voted in the Brexit referendum, but everybody that I know who knew her, and I knew her a little bit, I'm not going to say she was a personal friend or anything, but we met and talked on quite a few occasions. Everyone that worked with her, whether they were politicians or advisors, tells me that they don't think that she would have voted to leave the European Union. Now, We can't possibly say. She did become much more Eurosceptic. But if you read that famous speech that she made in Bruges in 1988, where she said, "Well, we haven't rolled back the frontiers of the state in Britain only to see them reimposed at a European level." If you read that whole speech rather than just that paragraph, it's a very pro-European speech. And a lot of her attitudes were actually quite pro-European. She got very frustrated with the Maastricht Treaty after she'd left power. And she did become much more Eurosceptic. But would she have actually gone that final mile and voted to leave? I'm really not so sure.
So describing sort of the end of the affair as it was. I mean, 1990, I remember the images. Mm. I remember how quickly it happened. I mean, you have to draw it as a, there isn't a celebration. And I mean, you can, and she is emotional. There are tears in her eyes. I mean, it's the end of a very long road.
Yeah. And it was, I mean, I think she actually had PTSD for the rest of her life after that. She couldn't understand how she could have been toppled by a cabinet when she had never lost an election. And who's to say that she wouldn't have won the 1992 election had she remained? Again, it's something we will never know, but it's entirely possible, particularly when she was up against Neil Kinnock, who she would trounce on an almost weekly basis. It was a traumatic time for her. She wasn't expecting it. But it was like John Biffin, one of her former cabinet ministers, said. He said, you know, when you put your destination into a Paris Underground map, the lights light up from where you are to where you want to go. And he said it was like this. Everything came together at the same time to enable her to be toppled. Now, she was only four votes off winning the first ballot by the margin that she needed to. So it was always very close. And she built up this narrative in her mind that it was a conspiracy by her cabinet to get rid of her. I don't believe that. I don't think there was a conspiracy. You can trace it back quite a long way, actually. I trace it back to the Westland affair in 1986, where she fell out with Michael Heseltine. Mm. And I think it all really stemmed from there. She became quite regal and imperious. Remember, we are a grandmother, or that kind of language. She had her finger on the pulse of the working classes up until then, and she somehow lost that, hence the poll tax, hence some of the other policies that she brought in her final years. She just lost that connection that she had built up with particularly the people who had bought their council houses in 1979. Now, they did remain quite loyal to her, but there was just something that changed after the Westland affair. And I remember saying, I was working in Parliament at the time, and I remember saying to the MP that I worked for, things will never be the same again after this, and they weren't.
One of the things that will strike me, and this is, I know you're busy, but one of the things that will strike me is her something she said after the 84, the bombing at the Grand. And she said, I realised that this was not a morning I was supposed to see. And people sort of brush off that, but that was horrendous. And it killed, obviously, four people, and Tebbit, Lord Tebbit's wife was very seriously injured. So I mean, again, she's a human being. This is one of the things, but I've always remembered that.
Well, I think the one thing that people remember from that awful 24 hours was when the conference was due to start at 9:30 the following morning. The bombing of the Grand Hotel having taken place, I think, at 2:54. And she made very clear they were going to continue with the conference. So she made her leader's speech. And I mean, she didn't brush the whole thing off, but she knew that she had to remain strong. And I think she went to church the following Sunday at Chequers and had that thought in her mind during the service. But she didn't allow the public to see any of that. The raw emotion, I mean, think of it. You've had five of your friends have died. You've got one of your closest cabinet colleagues and his wife in terrible, terrible pain with terrible injuries. I mean, you'd be inhuman if it didn't affect you emotionally. But as Prime Minister, she couldn't allow the public in to see that. Now, there were occasions when she broke down in public, when her son Mark was lost in the Sahara Desert in a rally. She got very emotional doing that in public. And obviously, you mentioned the day she left office, but there were a few other occasions too. For example, during the Falklands War, she wrote letters, 255 personally written letters, each different. There was no template, and no mail merge in those days. I mean, she wrote these letters to all of the families who had lost a loved one during the Falklands War. And somebody who witnessed this would say, I mean, she was writing each one crying. And that's the ultimate responsibility, in a sense, for a prime minister. And most prime ministers have to send British soldiers into combat in some form during their period in office. And I think we as the general public, we don't really understand that this is a deeply emotional thing, that there is a connection between the prime minister and the armed forces. And I think she had no regrets about doing this and knew it. She had to do it to take back the Falklands. But the emotional pressure on her, I think, during that time. And remember, she'd never, I mean, she was she was a teenager during the Second World War, and in a sense was a creature of the Second World War, but she hadn't fought. But she had people in her cabinet like Francis Pym, Willie Whitelaw, who had fought, and they had to sit her down occasionally and say, Margaret, there will be reverses here, there will be ships that are sunk, but you can't let it affect your judgment, you can't let it affect the decisions that you make. And it's a fascinating story. One of her former advisors, Chris Collins, is actually writing a book next year about her and the Falklands War. I think it's going to be absolutely fascinating. I think I don't know exactly how he's writing it, but I had this idea a few years ago to do it myself, but he beat me to it. And I was going to literally write the Falklands War through her eyes, day by day, minute by minute. And I think we'd learn a lot from that.
Fascinating stuff indeed. Are you hoping that your personal trainer will get a better idea of what a figure she was, Ian?
Well, every time I go and see him, I say, have you read it? Because I gave it to him about a month ago when I got the first printed copies. He says, I've read the introduction. And I think there are so many people of his age group now who just don't read books. And everything is on a screen. And okay, you can get this as an ebook as well. But I really hope he does read it, and I'd be interested to hear what he takes from it. And I think, look, there is that hackneyed old phrase, if you don't learn about history, you're condemned to repeat it. Well, I mean, there were lots of things in the 1980s that we would probably want to repeat. I mean, she was, in many ways, a very successful prime minister, but she did have failures, and we have to learn from those failures. And those of us who think that overall she did a really good job, we can't transplant 1980s Thatcherism into 2025. We live in a very different country. We live in a very different economy, still influenced by Margaret Thatcher. But you can't, for example, I believe in low taxes in a small state, but I recognised after COVID, probably there wouldn't be a small state agenda until after I'm long gone. And we couldn't have low taxes in the short term. I hope one day we will be able to again, but you can't just take a political ideology and translate it from one era to another.
Absolutely. I'm just looking forward to the 3-day week coming back. This book...
Well, we have it now with people working from home, don't we?
I mean, man, can you imagine? The book is called Margaret Thatcher. It's part of the Prime Minister series. It's by Ian Dale. It's out on the 5th, isn't it, Ian, officially?
It is. Yes.
If people want to follow you online and say nice things about you, where's the best place to find you?
You can find me on all sorts of social media at Ian Dale, but remember it's IAIN.
The book is called Margaret Thatcher. Ian, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you today.
Thank you very much.
COTA has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.